The Concerto for Two Flutes, Strings and Continuo in C Major RV533 by Vivaldi, played by the Zagreb soloists. And so this edition of Sunday Morning draws to a close. I do hope you've found it interesting, and thank you very much for listening. For the next 2 weeks, James is back again with his own carefully chosen selections. As always, I'll be listening at home while raiding my own shelves for my next appointment with you, which will be in 3 weeks' time on December the 29th. In the meantime, enjoy your listening. Do join James next Sunday, same time, 9 o'clock, here on Radio 3, and have a wonderful Christmas.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Neil Miners.
As part of a week of programmes on Radio 3 for the Richard Wagner bicentenary, the Sunday feature explores possibly the single most controversial place in classical music, the Festspielhaus at Bayreuth, the theatre that Wagner built for the performance of his operas in 1876. It's a place whose history reveals how Germany formed itself as a nation and how it reformed itself after the First and Second World Wars. And what's happened inside, on stage, in the productions of Wagner's operas is similarly revolutionary. I'm Tom Service, and for Radio 3, I'll be exploring this place of Wagner's dreams made real. Join me for this week's Radio 3 Sunday feature, starting at 6:45.
And now, Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is Tom Hooper, the director of King's Speech and Les Misérables.
Tom Hooper has somehow cracked the secret of making films that audiences really love. Whether you count Oscars and BAFTAs or box office takings, he is, at 41, right up there as one of Britain's top film directors. The King's Speech won him 4 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director, and earlier this year his film of Les Misérables won 3 more Oscars. The box office takings for Les Mis stand at an amazing $441.8 million. It's been a hit across the globe, with reports of audiences crying their eyes out in cinemas from Sydney to Japan. Well, more on that emotive crying later, Tom. But trying to get to the bottom of what makes you such a successful film director, let's start at the beginning, because it all started with a dog. A dog called Harry who ran away?
Yes, my first ever film was called Runaway Dog, and it was a comedy based on the fact that my cousins had a dog that used to run for miles and miles, and one of my childhood memories is pursuing this blasted dog for hours trying to catch it. It was made for a £25 budget on 16mm as a silent movie. I remember getting very preoccupied about what my first film represented, and possibly bizarrely worried that I might one day have to give an account of it on to someone like yourself. And my mother gave me some great advice, said, just do something as an exercise. Don't see this as, you know, your great statement to the world about what you most deeply care about. And it was, I suppose, a great first exercise film.
So you would have been, when you did Harry, how old would you have been then?
When I did Runaway Dog, it was Good Friday 1986, and I was 13 years old, and I decided to be a director about a year before and spent a year reading every book I could get my hands on, including the BBC training manual for young directors, and I decided I didn't want to be someone who just read about film. I wanted to make films, and discovered that my uncle had an old clockwork 16mm camera from the 60s sitting in his attic unused, so I managed to persuade him to let me borrow it, and shot my first film. But what I find extraordinary is that, you know, I was using a clockwork camera technology, shooting on film, and I had to be silent because I couldn't afford sync sound. And as I sit here now, my iPhone's on the desk, which could shoot an HD movie with sync sound of any length, pretty much, I could contemplate. And the democratization of film as a medium has been an extraordinary thing I've lived through.
Although that was a silent film, you very soon began to use music, and it's obviously been very important. It's been at the heart, to a certain extent, of a lot of your filmmaking, hasn't it?
Funnily enough, I owe music my dramatic beginnings, because the way I came to fall in love with filmmaking was through, first of all, falling in love with acting and drama as a child. And that was because I had a brilliant teacher at school called Roger Mortimer when I was 10, 11, 12, who put on one play a year for the kids, which I was cast in. And he also taught drama and he taught English. And through that, I developed an absolute passion for acting and drama. And basically what I appeared in was two musicals in a row. Firstly, The Beggar's Opera and then Patience. And so my love of drama started in musical form and started with me singing. And what's strange when I reflect back on what I was like as a kid is I was oddly strategic. I remember thinking, hold on, if I'm not getting a lead role in the school of 300, 2 years in a row, and I'm ending up in the chorus or with a small part, it probably means I should give up the dream of being an actor, because if I can't even be the best out of 300, I'm unlikely to be good enough out of my entire year group to pursue it. And I forced myself to give up the dream of acting at 12, which, when I look back on it, has a sort of savagery of realism. But it was, you know, it was around that time I was doing this ruthless analysis of my own talents. So I was very much drawn to the world of what Roger did as a director and the backstage world and the world of lighting, and began to realise there was this role of director. And it was really just stumbling on a library book that had been oddly left lying around on a piano at school that was about how film and TV is made that turned me onto film.
Strange in a way, if you think about it, that this John Gay's Beggar's Opera is a kind of very early musical.
Yes, and it was something when I started on Les Mis, it was strange to recollect that I could genuinely say that I'd started in the musical, and that was my first point of contact with being an actor and a performer. So there was a sense of going full circle when I directed Les Miserables.
Fill Every Glass from John Gay's Beggar's Opera. We heard the Argo Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Richard Austin. That feeling for the way things are made, lighting, which you did quite a bit of, I think, when you were taking part in those school productions, that feeling for what something looks like really does permeate your films in a very striking way. I could take almost any scene from, whether it be Red Dust or Les Miserables, and you feel that somebody has crafted the look of it with a great deal of affection for what it looks like.
Yeah, it was my, you know, when I was trying to work out what I could do, my great passion became stage lighting. Partly, I think, because this world seemed impossibly glamorous to the 12-year-old Tom, because, you know, these people sat in this special lighting box at the back of the theatre and, you know, in gloomy red light with banks of old dimmers and controls. And I knew that only one person per school year was given the chance to join the lighting team, and became my project to be allowed to be the person who was let into this team when I went into the senior school at Highgate at 13. And the moment I joined at 13, because I was so passionate about lighting, the guy who ran what was called the lighting box allowed me to design the lighting from the moment I entered the school, even though everyone else in the lighting box was older. And I used to love thinking about how to translate the drama of plays and musicals into light. And one of my nicknames, and I'm not sure whether I came up with it or someone else came up with it, and I wouldn't take it that seriously, was The Prince of Darkness, because but possibly, you know, I would justify a cool nickname in the context of school lighting, not in any other area of school where I definitely wasn't cool.
Well, there was an incident with dense smoke, wasn't there, which I suppose was a bit of darkness.
Yeah, the next track we're going to hear is, I have incredibly strong memories. There was an album called Phantasmagoria by The Damned, which the lighting box loved and introduced me to when I joined the gang at 13, and I must have listened to this record hundreds of times to an obsessive degree, in the way that you often do when you fall in love with an album. But I have a very strong memory of listening to this album when we rigged the lights, and I remember we'd flood the entire auditorium of the theatre with stage smoke to the point where you literally couldn't see your own hand, and then climb up 30-foot ladders rigging these pretty heavy lights on chains off the ceiling while we played The Damned so loud that all the glass shook in the auditorium and you could hear the light fittings shaking. And it's a very strong memory.
Places we used to play. My toys have all been packed away. The rocking horse rocks in its box. A spinning top and corporal clots are a dusty lot. Many times I said I'd drop you a line. I guess I'm just a rotten swine who takes his for fun when he should run. The damaged one is you, old chum. Who's the sucker now? Who's the sucker now? Could someone shed some light on this love affair and help to make me quite aware of what is meant by naked thoughts that have been sent. My memory is empty. Who's the sucker now? Who's the sucker now? Tell me.
So yeah, those opening notes, I'm right back in the self-induced fog on the top of a ladder. I mean, it's interesting, as I was listening to it, I realised that being part of the lighting box gave me a strong sense of belonging at a school where otherwise I felt a little bit of an outsider. And the way that through filmmaking you enter into these temporary but very intense communities of work, which become your kind of temporary family for the duration, is a rhythm of the creative life, which I feel like even now I still get used to, because this incredible friendships that develop, which you have to move on from or say goodbye to on this regular basis. And also it was that great love I had as a teenager of the kit. Like, I liked lighting because there's a lot of gear. and as a young filmmaker, right, you know, part of it was fetishizing just the, you know, the trucks and the equipment, and something which, you know, I hopefully have grown out of.
The Damned from the album Phantasmagoria with Edward the Bear, a song about growing up and putting toys away. And as you just suggested, in one sense, Tom Hooper, you never did put the toys away.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things I've got, which is unusual, is a direct line through to the 12-year-old, because the 12-year-old's ambition to be a feature director, you know, has maintained a constant. And I feel staying in close touch with the child in you is so important, because when you're a child, you have much more porous relationship to your imaginative life. You know, you're able to colonize imaginative worlds without the kind of self-censoring that adults start to do, and staying in that place of permeability between your imagination and, quotes, real life is a very key part of creative health, I suppose.
And that sense of total vision, which I very much get from you and from your work, is almost Wagnerian in its commitment.
The audience might be spotting a link here.
But actually, I think it is true, though.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I know this is a year where Wagner's being celebrated and we're reflecting back on his importance, but as a composer was incredibly important to me, because Wagner had this brilliant dramatic understanding that melodies could define character. Melodies could also be fused with an idea or a particular emotion. In my own work, this idea that you can create an association melodically between character and leitmotif and between emotion, character and melody has been very, very influential. I went to Rheingold recently at the Royal Albert Hall, and I just sat there thinking, my God, he has been so influential on film composing. It is kind of outrageous how much of a debt people owe to him.
And the way, with complete confidence, this opening unfolds over a pedal note, which he just holds for something like 340 bars.
Yeah, I mean, I remember my father had the collection of Schulte's The Ring, and I remember lying on the floor on my back listening to the overture of Das Rheingold, you know, just on the sitting room floor, and just having the most extraordinary kind of out-of-body experience, because it feels like in that overture he's suggesting the kind of primordial musical soup, the emerging of the building blocks of the concept of music, or the concept of a score. it's extraordinary. It still gives me complete frisson hearing it now.
We heard the opening of Wagner's Das Rheingold, and that was in the recording that Sir George Scholte made with the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. He is, Wagner, a composer who does... I mean, some people refer to him as being dangerous because it can affect you in such a way that you become almost addicted to it, and it's like almost no other musical experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the promise of drama that he creates that makes him appeal to me as a filmmaker. I mean, that overture is so full of promise of, you know, shit that's going to happen. You couldn't make it more. And even the way the violins, when they first come in, they're playing very near the bridge, so there's that slightly raspy, edgy, dangerous string sound that, you know, that if you get wrong, it can be quite painful on the ear, and the strings slowly become more melodious. You know, it's full of edge, and the brass sound is so edgy. I think it's the promise of storytelling that I love.
You used music in one of the earliest films you made, in your gap year before going to Oxford, which we're going to hear now. This is an extraordinary piece because it's kind of operatic, even though it's chamber music, because it has such a powerful subtext, doesn't it?
Yeah, this is a short film that I wanted to do to professional standards with professional crew and professional actors, obviously all having to work for free because I didn't have any money. And Painted Faces was the film that I made when I was 18. And, you know, for me, it was my calling card because Simon Channing Williams, Mike Lee's producer, came on as executive producer, and Channel 4 bought it and it got a cinema release and it went to the London Film Festival. So this was very, you know, it was an important moment for me. And I was looking for a piece of music to begin the film where you have an artist who's struggling to find the inspiration for a painting, and he's painted a character and he gets frustrated and he destroys the character and he's in a crisis of inspiration. And I found the Janáček because I lived next door to a neighbour called Cecily Mendelssohn, who was a violin teacher, and she tried to teach me violin, and I think I did it for about 3 years, never made a particularly nice sound, and much to her, well, I don't know whether to her chagrin or her relief, I gave up. But I think Mum said, well, why don't you ask Cecily, because she knows music better than we do, whether there's a piece she can recommend, and she came up with this extraordinary Janáček piece.
Thank you.
I was thinking that Cecily Mendelssohn, my violin teacher, I suppose something came out of it that was good, if it was even not my violin playing. And, you know, what's so great about that for the film is that those solo sections where the violin produces that extraordinary edgy sound creates a disquieting sense of the promise of something strange that's going to happen. And it's emotional also because I was thinking how much that film was probably autobiographical, because it related to that central anxiety that you can face and fight as a director, which is the anxiety of choice. You know, every time you shoot a scene, you almost have an infinite set of choices about where you place the camera, what the actor does. And I learnt in the end that the great cure for that was working at speed. When you work fast, you basically work off your instinct. And if you slow down too much, that's when this sort of second-guessing fear starts to come in. And so I've, in a funny way, always liked working quite fast since then, because it keeps me in touch with what that first instinctive choice is when I'm shooting.
We heard music from Janáček's second string quartet, Intimate Letters, played there by the Talik Quartet. Well, having had that success, Tom Hooper, you started working in television and made an adaptation of Daniel Deronda.
Actually, my first directing job was children's television, Biker Grove, and then I did EastEnders and then Cold Feet, and then I got the opportunity to do period dramas for the BBC, Love in a Cold Climate, and the one we're going to listen to, Daniel Deronda. Music is absolutely central both to the novel and the miniseries that I made, because it's about this man who thinks he's the illegitimate son of an aristocrat called Daniel Deronda, who turns out to be the son of a great opera singer, a contessa, who's also Jewish. And there are these musical themes in my Daniel Deronda, one, a aria from The Marriage of Figaro, which haunts, the melody haunts our hero long before he's made the discovery that there's this sort of operatic maternal revelation waiting for him.
In the Mozart, the Countess is singing about her sadness, suicidal sadness, because her husband has betrayed her.
Thank you.
The Countess's aria, Porgy Amor, from Mozart's Marriage of Figaro. We heard Sena Jurinac with the Glyndebourne Festival Orchestra, conducted by Vittorio Gui. Stanley Kubrick was quite an influence on you, Tom.
I've been very influenced by Kubrick's work. Partly this came about because my director of photography for many of my projects was Larry Smith, and I started working with Larry just after he'd been the cinematographer for Stanley on Eyes Wide Shut. And through Larry, I learnt about Stanley's love affair with the 18mm lens, which is this, I suppose, a mid-wide lens which he would use for framing people in medium close-ups and mid-shots. And what's distinctive about the lens is if you use it, you're choosing to place the characters in constant relationship with their landscape or their environment. I mean, broadly, there are two ways of shooting faces. One is to abstract the face from the background by using a long lens so that the background is a sort of out-of-focus mush, or one is to feel that the background is relevant to the psychology of the individual. And you'll see the way I explore this across my work. But, I mean, for example, in The King's Speech, the scenes in the consulting room where Colin sits in front of that distressed wall, I felt very much that that extraordinary kind of peeling wallpaper somehow was an analogue for his psychic state. And I felt that this was an example where the location we were in was expressive of psychology, and therefore I wanted to frame him in a way that put him in communication with that. And I also like the idea of putting lots of negative space in the frame to suggest the kind of the ellipsis or the absence or the silences of stammering. And in terms of my period work, and why it's good that we're talking about this after Andromeda, is Barry Lyndon was massively influential for me in terms of thinking about how I shot my period films. I mean, it was such a revelation. Rather than modernising a period to make it, quotes, relevant, it was much more interesting to fully immerse yourself in the research and the detail of a period, and through that there was a way of finding, you know, a different kind of truth. So the Saraband, Handel Saraband, which is the theme tune to Barry Lyndon and is also used throughout it, again, thinking back to the Wagnerian leitmotif, it's a leitmotif film, that was very powerful for me. And then in John Adams, which was my, you know, 9-hour miniseries about the American Revolution, as a kind of nod, an homage to Kubrick, I used the Saraband as well.
Thank you.
The Saraban from Handel's Suite for Harpsichord No. 4 in D minor, arranged for orchestra and played there by the National Philharmonic for the soundtrack to Kubrick's 1975 film Barry Lyndon. I wonder if in any way it's an advantage, Tom Hooper, or maybe it's completely irrelevant, that you're not completely English, your mother's Australian. And so you've always had a possible sense of seeing Britain at one remove.
Yeah, I'm half Australian, my mum's Australian, and I think it had a big influence on me growing up, because even something as simple as my mother going, I know it's grey and rainy here, but on the other side of the world it's beautiful, hot sunshine, you start to kind of see that there is a duality in all things. And my mother, growing up, you know, always saw England from an outsider's perspective, and therefore bequeathed me the possibility of seeing Britain from the outside, but also as an insider. So that possibility of being both inside and outside a culture was key. But the biggest advantage of having an Australian mother turned out to be with the King's Speech, where, you know, it was only because she was an Australian living in London that she was invited by some Australian friends to attend a play reading, like a sit-round-the-table play reading of an unproduced play called The King's Speech that the producers were trying to get set up as a theatre play. And my mother's Australian identity paid off, where she called me up afterwards and says, you know, you're not going to believe it, but I think I might have found your next film.
Really? <Yes. laughs> Do you think, compared to, for example, Australians, is there a restraint and inhibition in English life for you?
You know, The King's Speech was a very strange example of how something can become personal, but you begin to see it only once you're well into the production. So I don't think when I chose to do The King's Speech, I saw it as a personal film. But as I was making it, I became very aware that the dynamic between Bertie and Logue had similarities with my own parents, because, you know, my father was sort of the classic Englishman who, you know, went to full-time boarding school at the age of 5. He lost his father in the war at 3 years old. So he had quite a, you know, emotionally tough upbringing. And I don't think he was hugely close to his mother. And growing up, my mother was very critical of this sort of brutal boarding school upbringing that he'd had, and sort of said, you know, this would have affected your father emotionally, and so it's our job in the family to open him up emotionally and, you know, to unrepress him. And so the dynamic of an Australian with the freedom to challenge the English way and to say that the English way can damage people and this damage can be undone was rather similar to the dynamic between the Australian Lionel Logue and, you know, the Stuttering King.
And Beethoven plays quite a crucial role in The King's Speech, doesn't he?
You know, throughout my life, the suggestions of others are so important, and the wonderful editor, Tarek Anwar, who edited The King's Speech, from the very first time he showed me the climactic scene of Colin reading the speech, he'd put Beethoven's Seventh to it. And from the first time I saw it, I thought it was a brilliant suggestion, and it stuck. And when the wonderful composer Alexandre Desplat joined us, Alexandre, from the beginning, said, I'm not going to touch that. There's something brilliant about the DNA of that.
But you did record it on mics of the time, didn't you?
Yes.
Which is really interesting.
Actually, one of the most exciting musical moments of my life was sitting, we were recording at Abbey Road, and I took a chair, went into the studio, and of course, in the studio, you just have just the orchestra. There's no one else there. I put the chair right in the middle of the London Symphony Orchestra and listened to them play Beethoven right in the middle. And it's absolutely thrilling to be able to sit where basically no concert you'd ever be allowed to sit, right in the middle. But we had a wonderful recording engineer called Pete Cobbin, who's the main engineer at Abbey Road, who discovered that in the EMI archives were the original microphones that were built by EMI for King George V, King George VI, and the Queen Mother, including the very microphone that he delivered the wartime speech, which is used in the film. And so Alexandre, the composer, had the wonderful idea that we should actually hook these microphones up and use it, you know, as part of the DNA of our score and of the sound. And what was so exciting was to discover this, you know, 1920s and 1930s microphone technology lent this incredible warmth to the strings and a sense of period that balanced in and helped capture something special. And even just psychologically, there was something so special about knowing that we were using the very microphone that was being depicted in the scene that we were scoring.
Thank you.
Beethoven is such a genius. It is quite extraordinary. And to hear it live in that way, you know, I have a very vivid memory of it. And it's interesting listening to it in the context of what we've been talking about. Again, why does it work so well for a film? Because it has that wonderful build, going right back to the Wagner, the overture of Rheingold. It has the patience to build.
Well, where Beethoven's wonderful is that he has a kind of ability to conjure up the fragility of the human condition, doesn't he? And because we've actually got an almost stuttering boom, 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 yes, boom, it's a perfect marriage.
And isn't that string sound fantastic from the 1930s microphones? I mean, I think what's interesting is, you know, in the digital age,
what do we lose?
We have this obsession with perfection, but of course, sometimes the technology of recording lends something emotionally that has been lost.
We heard the second movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Terry Davis, recorded specially for the film The King's Speech. So there's music recorded for a film released in 2010, but on microphones made in the 30s. And that search for an authenticity, a conviction, if you like, brings us to Les Miserables and your decision to make the all-star cast sing live to the cameras. Anne Hathaway, Russell Crowe, Hugh Jackman, Eddie Redmayne, they're all singing their hearts out for 158 minutes as though it was the most natural thing in the world. It was quite a brave decision to do that.
I mean, the irony is it relates again to microphones, this time at the other end of the spectrum, which is the thing that had probably stopped directors doing musicals live in this way, was that you have to rely on radio microphones, which are those small microphones that you pin to people's chests. And until the last few years, it was simply inconceivable that you would get the quality of sound from a radio mic that would match a studio microphone. I felt from the beginning that I wanted to do it live, but not just do the singing live. As important to me was that, where possible, the accompaniment should be live as well, so that the actors could get to dance with the pianist accompanying them and be given control of the tempo of what they were singing. And this is quite unusual, because normally the tempo would be set by a conductor or it would be set by the accompanist. But in, you know, songs like Anne Hathaway's Dream to Dream, Anne was in control of the tempo, and I got very excited by giving the actors the freedom to go all the way in the range from speak singing to full singing, so that they could give themselves some of the control that dialogue would give you, even though they were singing.
I can't resist asking you, Tom, has this made you ever think at all about doing opera like this?
You mean filming an opera?
Yeah, I mean doing it with absolutely in that way.
Yes, I think it would be. I hadn't thought about it, but you'd now just give me the idea. So.
Well, that's something to think about. And then I mentioned at the beginning that people reduced to tears. I mean, I think that's something that's quite important to you, that you really move people, isn't it, in your work?
Yes, it is. I mean, the ending of The King's Speech seemed to really move audiences, mm-hmm. And I wanted to have that emotional connection with the audience. And one of the reasons I fell in love with the idea of directing Les Miserables was, as a musical, it's almost defined by its emotional response. I mean, when you go to the West End show, the person sitting behind you will be saying, this is my 9th time, this is my 11th time. Why is that? It's because the music has this extraordinary ability to re-deliver strong emotions each time you see it. And even the 5 or 6 times I watched it in the lead-up to the shoot, I found that my emotional connection was often getting stronger, not weaker. And that's very rare in any kind of storytelling, musical or otherwise, to create something where your emotional connection or response is protected or even deepened on repeat viewing. And I think that's the genius of Claude-Michel Schoenberg's score, that he's created this piece that only benefits from repeat experience.
Sadly, it's come to the point where we have to play you out. And so I'd like to invite you to choose a song from Les Miserables, perhaps tell us which one.
I think the greatest piece of composition, arguably, in Les Miserables is One Day More. I think it's an extraordinary piece of composition from Claude-Michel Schoenberg that stands with the greatest, and all the vocals in it, every single one, is done live. And so it's a fitting place to end. And it's also, there's lots of choruses in it, which takes me right back to being in the chorus of The Beggar's Opera, which is the journey, my creative journey coming full circle.
There you are, you see, organic, even to the end. Thank you very much, Tom Hooper.
Thank you, Michael.
one day more. Another day, another destiny. This never-ending road to Calvary. These men who seem to know my crime will surely come a second time, one day more.
I did not live until today. How can I live when we are parted?
One day more.
Tomorrow you'll be worlds away. And yet with you my world has started.
One more day all on my own.
Will we ever meet again?
One more day with him not caring.
I was born to be with him.
What a life I might have known.
And I swear I will be true.
But he never saw me.
Oh, I follow where she goes.
At the barricades of freedom,
shall I join my brothers there?
When our ranks begin to fall,
do I stay? Do I dare?
Will you take your place with me?
The time is now. The day is here.
One day more.
One day more to revolution. We will nip it in the bud. We'll be ready for these schoolboys. They will wet themselves with blood.
More.
Watch them run amok.
Catch them as a fool.
Never know your luck
when there's a free for all.
Here's a little dip.
There a little touch.
Most of them are gone and some of them won't miss much.
One means two and you can give. Raise a flag of freedom high. Every man will be a king.
My place is here, I fight with you. One day more,
we will join these people's heroes. We will know where they go. We will learn their little secrets. We will know the things.
One day more,
watch them run amok. Watch them as they go.
Never know your life when there's a rainbow road.
We'll be ready for this.
Tomorrow will be far away.
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow we'll discover what our God in heaven has in store. One more dawn, one more day, one day
Michel Schoenberg's One Day More from the soundtrack to the film of Les Misérables, ending this week's Private Passions. The programme and others from the series are available to download now. Just go to the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website and follow the links. Private Passions was presented by Michael Barclay and produced by Elizabeth Burke. It's a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3. And next week, Michael's guest is Jasper Conran.
Radio 3's Verdi 200 Bicentenary Year of Music continues with Opera on 3, Falstaff, live from New York. Verdi's late great operatic comedy from the Metropolitan Opera House, with conductor James Levine in the pit and Ambrogio Maestri in the title role. Falstaff, live on BBC Radio 3, Saturday night at 6 o'clock.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock and this is David Cornett with a summary of the news. Senior politicians have criticised plans to increase MPs' pay by five times the rate of inflation. The Independent Parliamentary Standards Authority is planning to raise salaries by 11% to £74,000 after the next election. The Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Danny Alexander, and the Defence Secretary, Philip Hammond, have said that they won't accept the pay rise. The Shadow Chancellor, Ed Balls, described the planned increase as a ridiculous recommendation. South Africans have been honouring Nelson Mandela at a day of religious ceremonies across the country. President Jacob Zuma thanked the people of South Africa for the way they had responded. He said it had gone a long way to healing the nation. In London, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, described Mr. Mandela as an example to other world leaders. Hundreds of thousands of protesters have again gathered in the Ukrainian capital Kiev to demand closer ties with the European Union. They want the government of President Viktor Yanukovych to resign and hold fresh elections. Police are questioning three people following new allegations that incidents in football matches have been fixed. The National Crime Agency began an investigation after a report in The Sun on Sunday. The newspaper says a championship footballer claimed to be able to get another player booked in return for money. The Army and the RAF have been helping communities which were affected by the flooding along the east coast of England. Soldiers have moved people out of their homes and built flood defences in Great Yarmouth to protect an electricity substation. In Middlesbrough, a Chinook helicopter lifted tons of sandbags to bolster sea defences before high tide. England's cricketers are heading for defeat against Australia in the second Ashes test in Adelaide. They were set a total of 531 runs, and they'll start the final day's play tomorrow on 247 for six. And the weather, it'll remain mild with sunny spells in the south, but wet and windy in Scotland and northern England. Tonight, any rain will be confined to western Scotland. There could be patchy fog in southern England. BBC News and weather at 3 minutes past one. And now the Lunchtime Concert, which is a recording of a recital given by the award-winning Pavel Haas Quartet. It took place in St Giles Cripplegate as part of the City of London Festival in 2009. We're going to hear a quartet by Haydn and then two pieces by Prokofiev. The Haydn is a D minor quartet that was published in 1786. It's his Opus 42. It's unusually short and seems to have been paid for by an unknown Spanish patron. The high violin part in the second movement was something of a Spanish characteristic at the time.
Thank you.